Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom, but we have some special guests. We get a special welcome. We have Lancaster High School students with us. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The Lancaster High School students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. It's cleverly entitled Court with Class. We invite students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. They agree to come. They're given materials about the case they are to hear with us. And they will, after this case is heard, meet with the justice assigned for the day to discuss the procedures that the court uses, taking a case, deciding a case, and issuing its opinion. The discussion will not include a discussion of the substantive issues of the case, and everyone is invited to join the students for this discussion right after this case. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, would you raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary.
Lady right there.
Ah, in the front. Mm-hmm. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will be meeting with the students after this case. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. To Justice Crooks' right is Justice Patience Rogensack. On the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case for today, 2013 AP 221, Dow Family LLC versus PHH Mortgage Corporation. Here's our lineup. Attorney Joe Thrasher, representing Dow Family, has 25 minutes and then 5 in rebuttal. Mary Susan Anderson, representing PHH Mortgage Corporation, has 20 minutes. Attorney John E. Knight, representing the Amicus Wisconsin Bankers Association, has 10 minutes. Is that correct?
Okay.
All right. We'll continue on that basis then. Attorney Thrasher.
Thank you, Your Honor. I am Joel Thrasher, counsel for Dow Family. We present, broadly speaking, two issues here, although they certainly have sub-issues. The first one, I think, is susceptible of a yes or no answer, and that is simply, does the statute of frauds apply to the assignment of real estate mortgages? Because it is a statute of relatively recent vintage, I don't think we need to dwell on late 19th and early 20th century case law, save to note that I hope the briefs establish that if there ever was a doctrine of equitable assignment of real estate mortgages as opposed to something else, it certainly did not become so ingrained in American jurisprudence that we should consider it engrafted by silence into a statute that in its present iteration
I'm going to interrupt you pretty early because before you get into argument. One of the things that bothers me about the case are the missing people in the case. So to me, missing people and missing things, okay? Was there ever title insurance here?
Yes.
There was title insurance?
Yes.
All right. And
there was a commitment, I know that.
I know there was a commitment, too. I want to know whether there was title insurance.
I think so.
Well, then, and the
Dallas had title insurance?
He said he thought so. That was your response.
Now, I'm not handling that, but it is my understanding that a title insurance company has been put on notice, has denied the claim, and things are just sitting until this.
Well, that's another second question I have about missing. My sense when I read all this is they had, you know, a lot of other lawsuits out there. And that I really don't need to know what they're all about, and I'm not here today to decide them, but what are they if there are? So, one, we have a title insurance case. Do we have malpractice against any lawyers?
I do not know the status of that.
Okay.
Other than I believe they were put on notice. I'm not involved in any way in either of those issues.
All
so
right.
I can give you what I think is the case, and that's all I know.
And what about Fannie Mae?
There is an inference that Fannie Mae is the owner of the note. I think it's only an inference. I don't think it's conclusive. The inference arises from an interrogatory answer saying that Fannie Mae funded the loan on a given date in 2001. What happened during the intervening 8 years up until Dow purchased this property, I don't think the record tells us. So I don't think that's conclusive, but there's an inference they own it.
Well, that leads me, at least for the moment, to my last what's missing. And frankly, I am a little surprised that here we are from the trial court to the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court, and the Court of Appeals, you lost there, but you know what the Court of Appeals did, as I understand it. They're sending it back to see if PHH Mortgage Corporation really owns the note.
Holds.
Okay. You know what? They sue for foreclosure, right?
Yes, although we had
actually... had a lawsuit.
Right.
You sued for what?
We commenced a declaratory judgment action.
Okay.
And then the foreclosure was filed, and those were consolidated.
And they were consolidated. Okay. But PHH has the burden of proof in a foreclosure action to show that it's the right party foreclosing, right?
Yes.
And to be the right party, it has to hold the note and the security, the mortgage, right?
That's because certainly our position.
Yes, and their position is that they get the mortgage for any number of reasons, including equitable assignment. And your position is, hey, whether it was, there is equitable assignment or not, they were split, right? And once the note is split from the security, right?
Right.
Then the security no longer belongs to the holder of the note. It is an unsecured note. That's your position. I understand it. And if I'm wrong, you should say so.
That is our position, but I want to make clear, we're not claiming that every MERS mortgage out there is invalid. We are claiming that at a relevant time in this case, they were split and therefore unenforceable.
Okay.
I'm not saying they cannot later come back together. There are commentators who would say that. We haven't gone that far, nor do we have to, nor does the court need reach that issue.
Well, how come we're here when we don't even know if we got the right party? We don't know the PHH is the right party, do we?
We do not, and we don't because a little thing called the summary judgment intervened before we could get to that discovery. And that's really why we're here.
Okay, you'll have to explain that to me.
The summary judgment came quite early in the litigation. There are obviously potential issues about not only who has the original note. There was an attempted written assignment of the mortgage, although that wasn't relied on for summary judgment. And if the case goes to trial, there are going to be issues about the authority of someone to sign it. There are a lot of things lurking there that were never reached because summary judgment was granted on the theory of equitable assignment, making all of the rest of that unnecessary. Now, the circuit court held the proofs were adequate with regard to holding the note. The Court of Appeals disagreed and reversed that much of it.
Okay.
So we then get to that equitable assignment that was relied on both by the circuit court and the Court of Appeals.
Now, our PHH did record an assignment of its mortgage, didn't it?
Ultimately, yes.
September 2010.
Yes. It was issued over or about 11 months after Dow purchased the property.
Okay. Now, I have one other question before you get started. Sorry. How can MERS be both an agent and a principal? Because it states in its mortgage, as I understand it, it's both the mortgagee and the agent of the mortgagee. Can one person be both principal and an agent?
I don't think so. I think MERS has created a mess, quite frankly. But here, what's important is there is no evidence that at the time of Dow's purchase, it was an agent for whoever owned or held the note. We raised that issue in summary judgment. Our brief is record item 50, I believe, and we specifically raised these issues. No responsive proof was forthcoming as to even conclusively who owned the note, but certainly not as to any agency relationship between that party and MERS. The record is totally devoid of that.
Oh, but what, you think MERS was the agent of U.S. Bank?
I don't know whether there is a document out there that would create that. The mortgage didn't create it because U.S. Bank was not a party to it.
Pardon me?
U.S. Bank is not a party to the mortgage. If there's a separate document creating an agency relationship, we have not seen it.
U.S. Bank lent the money, right?
Yes.
And MERS recorded the mortgage?
Right.
And how is MERS listed? Because, you know, the mortgage says from Sullivan's, Sullivan's, and then the mortgagee is listed, and usually there's a little description in it, like purchase money mortgage. Or
now, this is a MERS form. Actually, I think it's a Fannie Mae form. Fannie Mae is one of the organizations which was the architect of MERS. It's their form, actually. I think it's described as such. And it does identify the lender, but it also names MERS as mortgagee.
It says MERS mortgagee. Does it say MERS as agent?
As nominee.
Pardon me? As nominee. Okay. What does that mean?
As I understand it, a nominee is a very limited form of agency.
Okay.
But again, the bank wasn't party to that document.
All right.
So I don't think it created anything. Now, in terms of the equitable assignment, what we have to keep sight of is the operative key word in the term statute of frauds is statute. We're not talking about 19th century dicta. We're not talking about the restatement of property. We're talking about a statute which on its face clearly applies unless the exception in 702.001 sub 2 applies, and that simply says that transactions are excluded if an interest of land is affected by act or operation of law. That's a term of art, act or operation of law. And it means something entirely involuntary. And that argument has not been refuted in any of the three briefs which followed ours. But I did recently supply counsel with another citation, I think may be of interest, merely because it comes from the U.S. Supreme Court and shows how ingrained that concept is. And that is in United States against Seattle First National Bank. It involved whether there was a tax on certain transfer of securities. Now, keeping that in mind, we turn to two sentences at page 58788. We must look only to the immediate mechanism by which the transfer is made effective. If that mechanism is entirely statutory, effecting an automatic transfer without any voluntary action by the parties, then the transfer may truly be said to be wholly by operation of law. But again, our position hasn't even been refuted on that. So if the Uniform Commercial Code, which we now get to, is interpreted as respondents would interpret it, we would have a head-on clash between two statutes. But we do not need to read the Uniform Commercial Code that way. Because
may I ask a question? How much money does your client, the Dow family, owe, in your opinion?
I don't have the current rate before it. It's whatever is in the judgment plus interest.
What do you think they need to pay, and who do they have to pay it to?
Our position is they do not, if we hold that there was no effective lien at the date of purchase, which was in 2009. At that time, we know the mortgage was in the name of MERS, and we know MERS did not hold or own the note. We don't know conclusively who did, but we know conclusively MERS did not.
Okay.
So
at the time that your client acquired the property, were there mortgages recorded on that property?
There were other liens. There were two that were satisfied at closing.
Okay. So, I mean, they weren't surprised that there were mortgages on the property.
No. No, this was not just a condominium unit. This was a buyout of an interest in an entire business. This is a resort restaurant on Stout Island in Red Cedar Lake. It was a business transaction, not a residential one. This particular issue involves only one condominium unit, but there was much more involved.
Now, but in answer to Justice Prosser, I closed many a deal, and I'm not surprised that there's a lien, but we pay it off because we want a warranty deed. We want property free and clear. Sometimes we buy subject to a lien, right? Okay. When your clients bought this and paid off some of the liens, what about this one? Did they know about this mortgage? Did they expect that they would be paying it off? Or at the time of the closing, was it their position that there was no mortgage on this no other mortgage on this property? And if anyone owed money, it was the Sullivans, because the Dows had no, never made a promise and never assumed it.
Oh, they never assumed it.
Okay.
But there were multiple mortgages, two, according to the title commitment, in favor of U.S. Bank. That was incorrect, but that's what the title commitment said. And Sullivan, the seller, represented through counsel, and this is in the record, that the second U.S. Bank mortgage refinanced the first, and the first no longer existed. Now, the record does not include what efforts were made by the buyer to check with the bank. If this court ultimately holds there is a lien, that's something that has to be explored at trial. But everybody thought it didn't exist.
Okay, so you bought it, you're thinking, free and clear of the mortgage we're fussing about now.
Absolutely, yes.
All right.
And, of course, the maker of the note subsequently went bankrupt, so here we are.
That's the Sullivans.
That's the Sullivans.
That's
You can't say that everybody thought it didn't exist. I mean, it may be that the Dows didn't think it existed.
Right.
But that isn't everybody.
No, I don't know subjectively what Sullivan thought. I only know what they represented. And that was the mortgage had been satisfied.
And you don't know whether U.S. Bank was consulted by anyone. They were not there. And that will have to
I
be
I do
settled.
Know, but the record doesn't.
Okay. All right.
Now, let's get real simple. Sullivans acquired a piece of property. They borrowed $146,000 to help them acquire that property. And there was a mortgage, there's a note and there's a mortgage, and the mortgage is recorded. And then they borrowed another $140,000. And there was a mortgage on that, and that was recorded.
Right.
Okay. Now, then the property was transferred from the Sullivans to the Dows. Didn't change the mortgages. Didn't change how much money was lent by U.S. Bank. It's simply the Dows didn't quite appreciate that there were three mortgages on this property.
One unrelated, yes.
Yeah, unrelated. Okay. Now, what did MERS or U.S. Bank or PHH or Fannie Mae or anything do that sort of treated the Dows unfairly and didn't let them know that there were two or three mortgages on the property?
Oh, there's no such claim. The only issue is whether that mortgage, in fact, constituted a superior lien at the date of purchase. That's all. We don't dispute that there was a note, there was a mortgage, and apparently the representation that it had been paid off was false, and the title examiner got it wrong when they named the mortgagee. There's no dispute about any of this. And nobody's talking unfairness. We're talking the law. Was there a lien? Well, to get to that point, we have to get around the claim of equitable assignment or the Uniform Commercial Code. The code on its face only applies to reassignment of mortgage notes as security, not to out-and-out sales. One of the non-party briefs does makes cross-reference to another statute which supposedly will turn the first one into something it doesn't plainly say. And reference was made to Section 409. Excuse me. I don't think that was the one. Anyway, it's 2009 Act 320. And that cross-reference statute, according to the pocket parts and in the actual paper version of the statute's annotated, indicates that the cross-referenced statute was not effective until August 1, 2010 and only applies to transactions on and after that date, which is well over a year after the Dow transaction. So we see no reason to read the UCC as going beyond its plain language and not applying to outright sale of notes.
Now, just go through your position on the UCC somewhat again. Your position is that the UCC provision does not apply here. Is that correct?
Yes.
Now, I'm not talking about the one that came into effect after in 2010.
Right.
I found the UCC hard to read. That's putting it mildly. But, of course, I was educated before the UCC. I went to law school before the UCC. So I'm at a disadvantage. So tell me what your argument is about the UCC. And I think we're talking about 409.203 sub 7G. Is that right?
Correct.
And it's on your brief at 19, 29, 30, 31, 32, 34. So since I couldn't understand it, I had a little problem. All right. Mr. Thrasher, I used to help you out. Now you have to help me out.
All right. It states, the attachment of a security interest in a right to payment or performance secured by a security interest or other lien on personal or real property is also attachment of a security interest in the security interest mortgage or other lien. Yes, it's difficult language, but what it
means... It refers to real estate, which surprised me because of my basic understanding was UCC applies only to personal property, intangibles.
Right.
Go ahead. So tell me what this means and why you don't think it applies to you.
It means that if I hold a note and mortgage from somebody, I loan them money, I've got a note and mortgage. Now, I turn around and borrow from someone else. I can assign that original note and mortgage to them as additional security. They can only foreclose on it, though, if I default and the original note maker defaults. It's not out-and-out ownership. And the language of the statute does not extend to out-and-out sales of securities or notes, which is a different issue. Why would it draw that distinction? I don't know, but I have an idea, and that is exactly as Your Honor suggests, is to stay as far out of the real estate field as they can. If the code were to get into mortgage assignments or out-and-out sales, now it's dealing with real estate, which is something it chooses not to do.
So as I understand your answer, this UCC provision applies when a note and mortgage is used as security for another loan.
Yes, precisely.
But does not apply in this case because in this case we have outright, it is alleged, we have outright transfers of the note ultimately from UCC to PHH.
Right.
So PHH claims. And MERS has the mortgage, and it claims it's holding it for whoever holds the notes.
Right.
Right? So the UCC doesn't apply because that only deals with secured transactions.
Yes.
And this is an outright assignment. Okay.
Right. That is our position quite clearly. As a final note, there are some things that nobody disagrees with, and that is, first, a mortgage can only be enforced by or on behalf of a party entitled to enforce it. I think, secondly, factually, there's no way around the fact that this record shows that MERS did not satisfy that position on the date of sale. And so the question is, now what? Was there a lien or was there not a lien if no one could enforce it? And on that subject, I would simply refer to...
You'll have to take that again. On the date of sale, that's the one we're talking about, right?
In 2009.
What were the requirements for foreclosing?
Whoever is attempting to foreclose must hold or own the note or be acting in an agency type of relationship, none of which shows is established on this record. And that takes us to the restatement of property, which has been cited against us in three separate briefs, which says that when the right of enforcement of the note and the mortgage are split, the note becomes, as a practical matter, unsecured. So it is simply our position that it did not constitute a lien.
To repeat that, too. If the note and the mortgage become split, according to the restatement of property...
This is a comment, not...
Right, I understand. If they become split, then the note is unsecured.
Or that...
What does the mortgage holder have? The mortgagee have?
What do they have?
Yeah.
For the time being, a useless piece of paper.
I expected that to be your answer, but even though your red light is on, I want you to once again explain to me why what I was taught from the first few weeks in property is that the mortgage follows the note, and that there's a, I don't remember the term equitable assignment, but that they go together. If I knew the name of the song, I would say it, but go ahead.
Well, the laws of 1969 adopted a statute of frauds, which says otherwise.
And that's what you're relying on?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. Ms. Anderson, attorney Mary Susan Anderson, representing PHH Mortgage Corporation.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and good morning, and good morning to all the justices, Attorney Thrasher and Attorney Knight, and Lancaster High School students. It's a real pleasure to be here. I haven't been back here since Dean Eisenberg moved my admission in 1998, and he told me that if I ever got back here, I better make him prouder he would come and find me. So I think I'm going to get struck down by lightning if I don't do well today.
Okay. Counsel, I'd like to talk to you about missing items, too, of people.
Yes, ma'am.
And when between, 2001, was that when U.S. Bank lent $146,000?
Yes, ma'am.
And then you got the note in 2009?
No, ma'am.
When did you get the note?
Sure. This is the way this worked.
And who is Sendant?
I'll go through all that with you.
Good.
While I'm doing that, hopefully I can address some of your questions, good, Justice Prosser's questions, to clear some what I believe to be misstatements of the true facts of record here. Now, let's be clear. We're here on a summary judgment record.
All right.
We're here on a limited record. So I'm going to point you to things that are actually in the record. Okay. In May of 2001, on May 17 to be precise, the Sullivans, the predecessors in interest to this parcel, signed a note and a mortgage on the same day. The note and the mortgage are very clear. The note and the mortgage reference each other. The mortgage references the note references the mortgage. The mortgage references or cites the borrowers as the Sullivans, the mortgagee as MERS, as nominee for lender. And lender is expressly defined in the mortgage as U.S. Bank. The Sullivans also signed a note on the same day. U.S. Bank brought the money to the table, and then the note, the original note, was sent to my client, PHH Mortgage Corporation. And they received it on or about 5/22/01. And when they received the original note, they became, Chief Justice, what is called in the UCC literature a PEAT, not a person, but a person entitled to enforce. There is no question that Article 3 of the Uniform Commercial Code comes into play here, Chief Justice. Under 403.301, the holder of a note endorsed in blank, such as is the case here.
Well, we don't know that because you don't have an authentic copy.
I have it in my desk drawer. But I'm we didn't appeal that issue, Judge. We didn't ask this court for assistance because, and then, you know, for efficiency and time's sake, it's just as easy for me to go into court and show everybody the original. Okay? So.
And it's endorsed in blank by whom?
Okay. To
because
answer
you had a copy in the trial court, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So I can look at the copy and who endorsed
right.
it.
Right. So first of all, U.S. Bank National Association specially endorsed it to Sendant Mortgage Corporation,
right,
which is now known as PHH Mortgage Corporation. And then Sendant Mortgage Corporation endorsed it in blank. So then after that point, whoever's got that note in their hand, whoever has the physical possession of that note endorsed in blank gets to enforce.
It's negotiable under the code?
Yes, ma'am. It's a negotiable instrument under the code. And that's why PHH, I mean, for purposes of this argument, I understand that has to be decided ultimately at the circuit court level. But we really, why we're here is assuming that.
What was the date that Sendant endorsed it in blank?
Endorsements are not required under the code to be dated.
Okay. And what about the special endorsement? When was that dated?
Same answer.
No date.
No, endorsements are not required to be dated, and they often are not. Mm-hmm. So the documents that the Sullivans signed, there's no secret about who was doing what and who played what role. MERS was front and center with contact information. The lender was identified. So when PHH went to foreclose on this note, Judge, a couple of things. Number one, on this record, there is no title policy. There is a title commitment, which, as Justice Prosser pointed out, expressly lists this 2001 mortgage. And to be clear, there is no dispute that the 2001 mortgage was properly recorded with the Barron County Register of Deeds and was available for anyone to find. Dow family had actual notice of the 2001 mortgage from the title commitment that it received. And to be sure, it's very important to recognize that the title commitment states, if you want a title policy, you've got to satisfy all of these mortgages. The 2001 mortgage, like any mortgage, is a snapshot in time. It says what the mortgage amount was at that time, and it gives a lien. It's a lien. It is in rem against the property, whereas a promissory note is in personam. That's how I like to think of them. And as far back as the first year this court was the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Judge, the doctrine of equitable assignment has been in full force and effect. And this new argument that was made today that wasn't in the briefs about this wholly by operation of law, we don't even need to go there because way back in Kaidu Out, at least that's how the circuit court judge told me to pronounce it because I said I have no clue how to pronounce this one, in Kaidu Out, has already addressed the question of what does by operation of law mean in this context. This is not a tax case like the 1944 U.S. Supreme Court case that Dow cited. This is a mortgage foreclosure case. And it's no different than when you were in law school, Judge, your first day of property,
well,
the mortgage follows a note.
You have a basic problem as I see it.
Okay.
And that is that you want to come in under laws that were adopted and operating when I borrow money, well, the Sullivans borrow money from U.S. Bank, and U.S. Bank holds the mortgage in its name and holds the note, and every month I pay the mortgage to U.S. Bank.
You pay to PHH.
Occasionally, I'm a borrower. Occasionally, U.S. Bank might transfer to Anchors Bank in Madison for whatever reason they have in mind. And then I'm notified, please pay Anchor Bank. And Anchor Bank has an assignment in writing from U.S. Bank and records it. Pick to Barron County, you can pick Dane County. I don't care which county you pick. And if I go to the Register of Deeds, I can track it in the land index or in personal index, grantor, grantee, mortgage, or mortgagee indices. I can find all that. We are now dealing in late 20th century, early 21st century, where we have a totally different way of dealing with mortgages. And the question the real question in this case is, how are we going to put together that 18th, 19th, and 20th century, early 20th century law and real estate practice into the 21st century, where we have some unknown MERS, who is now a nominee, and it's going to hold all these papers. Not really all of them, because the note goes that way. MERS stays here, and MERS doesn't do anything but sits around with its recorded paper. And then 8 years later, is it, or 9 years later, some unknown person, not known to U.S. Bank, not known to Sullivan, is sitting with the note, and then MERS is going to make an assignment of the mortgage. That's all new, different, and is commercial transactions that don't fit the laws that were adopted for recording. And that's the problem with this case. And I don't know that PHH, you tell me that there's a piece of paper signed in blank, and that ultimately PHH is going to produce that original signed document, but it's not here. And from the perspective of the mortgagor who has to promise to pay, who knows who they pay to? I mean, some strange animal.
Well, let me
gives
try.
Them a thing. So that's my problem with the case in a broad view. And the details, you know, I can handle details
okay.
about UCC. I can handle equitable assignment.
Okay. Let me, I was really listening carefully to your question, so I hope I'm going to answer everything that you've asked me or address your concerns. Chief Justice?
Are we finished on the facts? Have you set them forth? You're going to get us from...
Yeah, it kind of goes back and forth here, doesn't it? But that's okay.
The defendant, PHH, got this through an endorsement
they got it.
In blank.
Yes.
MERS was the nominee, okay? No title commitment, no title insurance in the record.
The Sullivans paid for 8 years.
Pardon me?
They paid PHH Mortgage Corporation for 8 years. They received what in the trade is called a hello and goodbye letter. And that is a notice that PHH was going to be servicing their loan. They received it, they signed it, they sent it back, made payments to PHH for years. When it came time to sell the property, Chief Justice, they have a purchase agreement with Dow. And in that agreement, it specifically states that all property transferred herein is, as is, where is, that all property transferred hereunder is, subject to approval of the title commitment to be provided to Dow, which it was, listing the 2001 mortgage. All property transferred hereunder shall be subject to all mortgages, liens, and encumbrances. Dow expressly agreed to assume any and all mortgages. There's no question the 2001 mortgage has never been satisfied. It's of record. You follow the trail. Assignments of mortgage are not required to be recorded, and here's why they're not. As this court said long ago in Tidewell, the transfer of the notes to the plaintiffs carried with it, by operation of law, all securities for their payment. It doesn't matter to the borrower, to the debtor, who owns the note, because all they need to do is pay the debt but once. The securities pledged for a debt follow it. In equity, no matter how the debt may be modified or into whose hands it may come. That doctrine is entirely consistent and works entirely well with the statute of frauds and the UCC. In fact, the system that's in place works well and is demonstrated by the facts of this case. For some reason, Dow's counsel chose to rely on a statement from U.S. or from the Sullivan's counsel that, hey, look, the 2001 mortgage isn't here anymore. It's been satisfied. It's gone. Only a satisfaction of mortgage was obtained for 2003 mortgage. And there's nothing in the record, and I was not aware, that there was ever a title policy issued. if they had gone to close this.
Well, if they'd issued a policy, it would have had the exception for the mortgage. So it isn't going to do anything anyway, whether it's there or not, right? I mean, no title company is going to issue a policy that doesn't accept a mortgage that they give you notice is already there unless it gets paid. So they may issue a policy, but you'll still have the first mortgage as an exception to clean title.
Yes, yes. And this first mortgage was in the tract index. This title company found it, Stewart Title found it. And it was easily and readily found.
Counsel, you said that the Sullivans were notified that, was it PHH was there? What did you say, service, was servicing the loan?
Yes, ma'am, and that is at our appendix at 30, and the record site is R28, colon 65, and that's Exhibit E.
Were they notified that they were now holder of the note or just servicing?
The assignment of the servicing of the mortgage loan to PHH Services, they were notified that it is being assigned, sold, or transferred from U.S. Bank to PHH Mortgage Corporation. The Sullivans were not in any way prejudiced by the transfer of this note, I mean, which is reflected by the fact that they made the payments for 8 years. And I see that my light is on, and I'm wondering...
You have a few minutes on your main time.
All right. I wanted to get to the statute of frauds argument, because, I'm so sorry. I'm throwing things at Mr. Thrasher. Sorry about that. I know. Okay. First off, Judge, I think the statute of frauds melds perfectly with the concept of a person entitled to enforce under 403.301 and the 150-year doctrine of equitable assignment, because it says, of course, by operation of law, that's an exception. This Court's held for 150 years, and all the cases are cited in the brief, that wherever the note goes, the mortgage follows, like a train in a caboose. That's how I think of it. Not only that, but there was, in the record, the 2001 mortgage. So that did completely satisfy the statute of frauds. All they had to do was work with their title company to determine that the lien had not been satisfied. So they didn't have to record an assignment of mortgage because the mortgage had already been equitably assigned.
Counsel, what do you expect? I have two questions for you. One, I want you to outline the opinion for me that you would like this Court to write. And two, I want you to tell me whether there's anything in the Court of Appeals opinion disagree with.
Okay. And your first question was, you wanted me to outline what I want the opinion to say?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I think the Court of Appeals opinion should be affirmed. Mm-hmm. I think that, stare decisis is very important here, as Mr. Knight will discuss. Mm-hmm. That doctrine is well ingrained in commercial practice. And so if this Court's going to depart from that precedent, it needs to be careful in doing so for that reason. Second, I think that there is an exception to the statute of frauds because the assignment happened by operation of law. So I think that needs to be affirmed. And because Dow had notice via the title...
The operation of law is equitable assignment.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, go ahead.
And because the Dows had actual notice pursuant to the title commitment of this lien against the property that had never been satisfied, they cannot be a good faith purchaser under Bump versus Dahl, Associated Finance, and all of those cases cited in the brief. I think the decision should be affirmed. One last point.
What about we conclude the circuit court erred by granting PHH summary judgment because PHH failed to make a prima facie case it's entitled to enforce the note?
I did not appeal that, Judge, or seek review from this court of that for the reasons that I stated. So I'm going to go back into court and show everybody the original and be done.
All right.
So I don't really think that's before the court except just for background purposes. This whole idea of this split note theory, I think MERS addresses it in its brief, and I think Mr. Knight will also address it, but that is just simply not the law. Commercial practice here really hasn't – let me start over. As long as you hold that note endorsed in blank, you have the mortgage as well. And as long as the debtor knows who to make the payments to, there's nothing inequitable about this. There was no hiding of anything here. The only reason we're here is because that mortgage wasn't satisfied and nothing was done about it. The assignment of mortgage, however, was indeed recorded within about 2 days after PHH filed its amended complaint. But not only is it not required to be recorded, but on the assignment of mortgage, it was executed April 13 of 2010. And that's page 81 in our appendix. So I think the equitable doctrine of equitable assignment of mortgage is alive and well. For the reasons in the brief, I think it has been codified in 409.203 sub 7. And I think that Article 3 and Article 9 meld and mesh perfectly with the doctrine of equitable assignment because that doctrine has framed the very drafting of the UCC, and it's ingrained in commercial practice. So I'd ask that you affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. And thanks very much for having me today.
Thank you, counsel. And we will turn to Mr. Knight, who represents the Amicus Wisconsin Bankers Association.
Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. My name is John Knight. I'm appearing here this morning on behalf of the Wisconsin Bankers Association as an amicus, and we respectfully urge you to uphold the decision of the Court of Appeals. We think it got the issues correct and correctly addressed and cited the correct law. Our interest in the case is with respect to one issue, and that's the one you've been talking about at great length here with the other counsel, and that is the equitable and automatic assignment of a mortgage to the holder or owner of the note. One follows the other, and it follows it automatically. Case law in our state is strong. We've got old and we've got some that's not so old, but there's nothing wrong, at least at my age, in acknowledging that something old is good. And in this case, we go back to the mid-1800s.
Something old is good, but commercial practice has changed dramatically. Hasn't it?
Practices have changed, but Chief Justice, those practices have acknowledged and accepted and been developed based upon these established rules of law. The practice regarding mortgage following the note, although it goes way back to the mid-1800s, as we all now know, then codified in the UCC, and I'm convinced of that, and I can track that through if you wish. The practices of banks and other lenders in this field develop based upon established law. They don't try to create it. And although the practices are changing, they do appear to work, generally speaking. Not always. In this case, it should have worked, but for some reason, the buyer took the property subject to a mortgage and didn't get the mortgage satisfied. didn't get the title company to insure over it. You know, maybe if the title company had done the search that the buyer apparently did and called the seller and said, well, that mortgage doesn't exist and here's why, maybe the title company would have insured over it. I doubt it. But in any event, they took it subject to a mortgage, and here we are. And we've got that particular incident stacked up against very old case law in our state, around the country, codification in the UCC, and practices based on this law. And it's not only MERS. I don't think of this case as a MERS case. I mean, to me, that's not the issue. The issue is the equitable assignment of the mortgage or the mortgage following the note. And I remember that discussion in my law school class as well. But it comes up for banks in a variety of ways. We do sell notes. We'll sell a note that has a mortgage, and it does not involve MERS. It's sold simply to another buyer.
The banks sell a note to several people, or when they're packaged, do several people get parts of the notes?
Well, for the banks that I represent, they aren't directly securitizing the notes. That might be done further down the chain, but at the local level, it's not. I'll represent a bank, for example, that goes and buys a branch bank from another bank. Very common in our state. And when you buy a branch bank, you buy the loans directly. So we might get 1,000 loans secured by mortgages. We nor the banks buying it are rushing to record assignments. They'll follow this rule. They'll follow the UCC. They'll rely on it. Now, in some instances, they may have to record if they want to amend the mortgage. They're probably going to have to be a record to do that. There may be a variety of reasons why they would subsequently want to record an assignment, but not always. If we buy the assets of a failed bank, we've had six in our state fail. Nobody buys the bank. What they do is they buy the assets. That is, they buy the loans. And again, there could be thousands of them secured by mortgages. So the mortgages come with the note. The loan is identified. The paperwork is done. All the documents come along with it. We own the note, and therefore we're also now, we have the right to enforce the mortgage.
You say, and I understand that, you say MERS is not involved, but MERS holds this mortgage. What does it mean to say MERS is the nominee?
Well, I think the answer by Mr. Thresher was correct on that. I mean, I think it's a form of agency. So you'll see things like that in mortgages, whether it be MERS or it might be a large bank acting for other banks in a syndicated kind of capacity, and it'll be identified in that capacity. So you might see one organization acting as an agent or nominee for another.
Mr. Knight, Mr. Thrasher cited a case from New York, Bank of New York versus Silverberg in 2011. Your comment on that case?
I don't recall it specifically. Is it a MERS case?
I'm trying to. It seems to me it is. It is one that challenges equitable assignment. It's a principle that applies here, if memory serves me correctly.
And there are holdings from time to time challenging or degrading to some extent the equitable assignment of mortgage. I don't deny that. It may be the case cited by Mr. Thresher, but it's uncommon. It's really quite rare, and there are just a lot of cases around the country supporting and upholding the equitable assignment of the mortgage, relying on the UCC, which is a uniform law in all of our states, and based upon its commentary, expressly incorporates that common law. So I don't deny that those occasional cases may exist out there, but to me, this isn't that kind of case. This is really, in response to one of your earlier questions, it's really kind of simple, at least in my mind. You know, if you just kind of take the MERS issue out of it, MERS isn't even a party to this case. We've got a note. We've got a mortgage. The mortgage exists. The note was transferred or sold. The mortgage followed it along based upon established common law, based upon the UCC, based upon the restatement of property. And the law doesn't allow these two instruments to be separated. If the law were to allow them to be separated, we're going to end up with windfalls to people or organizations that aren't entitled to them. In this case, the buyer would get the property free of a mortgage it knew about and doesn't have to pay it off. If they get separated, the note becomes unsecured. The collateral is gone. Somebody got a windfall. Some holder of that obligation, somebody obligated to pay that, got a windfall. There are all kinds of circumstances where people and organizations will experience a windfall and aren't entitled to it. In this case, the borrower owed the money, paid it until selling the land. The buyer takes the property subject to a mortgage and knows about. But then, perhaps as a result of a court decision, ends up holding the land free of the mortgage. To me, that's a windfall, unintended. So I think separating the note and the mortgage is not a good precedent, and it's one that our state hasn't followed for quite some time.
If Sullivan wanted to get a payoff and get a release of that first mortgage, how do you get in touch with MERS to get a satisfaction?
Well, if I recall correctly from Mary Sue Anderson's brief and perhaps even discussion with you this morning, the mortgage document itself gave that kind of contact information and a number that one could identify the mortgage with and so forth.
And according to some documentation about MERS put out by the County Association, the mortgage is in a MERS system and receives an 18-digit identification number. And every time the mortgage is sold within the MERS system, no assignments are recorded, and each mortgage is sold four times within the MERS system. And people who object to this, and from what I've been able to find out in my research, loads of cases, maybe over 400 cases in the country relating to this MERS system. And most are in favor of MERS, with a few saying that this just does not meet the statutory system in the state, which was designed for a very different mortgage system, commercial system, and that what's problematic is to get foreclosure, that the paperwork is not easily and readily obtainable, that counties, which probably don't concern you, are losing a lot of money because the mortgage assignments aren't being recorded, and that we no longer have, as a result of the non-recording, a transparent, easily defined land registry system, because it's not of interest to MERS to record assignments, because it would have to do it every umpteen days or weeks or months or years.
Well, and the law up to this point hasn't required it. And the mortgage, by the way, Chief Justice, and it's our What's the record here? So the mortgage itself states, MERS is a mortgage that gives the name. It's a separate corporation that is acting solely as a nominee for lender, lenders identified, and lender's successors and assigns. MERS is the mortgagee under this security instrument. MERS is organized and existing under the laws of Delaware and has an address and telephone number of and gives them, gives you the address and gives you the telephone number. So
that's one of the things I first asked Mr. Thrasher. How can it be both mortgagee and nominee? How can it be principal and agent? I didn't go back to agency law, but.
And it also gives a an identification number.
Right, that's the 18 number
Uh-huh. Way to get the information. What's inexplicable to me as I look at this case, I have so many of the same questions you do, is how it got this far in the condition it's in. And why would a buyer take subject to a mortgage knowingly? And then there's provision in the document that Mary Sue Anderson, counsel, mentioned this morning, where the buyer agreed to assume responsibility for certain of the existing mortgages. If they had dealt with it then, we wouldn't be here today, one way or the other. I mean, in my practice, if there's a mortgage, I'm getting a copy of it. As a lawyer for the party, I want to know what it says, and then would never walk away from title insurance or getting a satisfaction. So there's a piece of this that just is inexplicable to me. But I think that the rules that we're dealing with, the rules of law, are relatively straightforward, longstanding, and easily understood. And I include the statute of frauds and its exception for something created by the operation of law. And one of this court's early decisions, going back to, unfortunately, the 1800s, says that the mortgage follows the note by, quote, operation of law.
What surprises me is how it gets here when you have all these other open questions that have to be resolved.
Right.
And we're taking one piece of this, not knowing these other pieces, they might affect the decision on this one piece. That's what bothers me. But it's here.
It's here, and we're here.
I
just wanted to comment, too. I think that to make changes now is really going to be difficult in costly and troublesome and burdensome to parties to existing transactions. And we're talking a lot of transactions. This
it
court
would shut
changes
down the whole secondary market of selling mortgages and transferring the obligations to collect payment on them on a
right.
servicing agreement. A whole separate industry exists because of this.
That's correct. And so that it, when you change it, as you all know, I mean, that's going to affect things already out there, and it's going to be enormous and pretty burdensome and pretty difficult and pretty costly.
I am very sympathetic about changing commercial practice without notice to the parties, when you've got a lot of people who depend on settled law. I don't have any problem that is not something the court should do, but I have found when commercial practices change, the people who are doing the change explore how their change in commercial practice is going to hold up under the law. And this is not a perfectly apt analogy, but I'm going to give it. So when you start getting scientific evidence that the tobacco might be dangerous to health, you get the tobacco industry looking that up and finding out what their liability would be and making appropriate practices. Same thing about lead paint. the industry takes into account. Same thing about usury laws, which is closer to this because it's commerce, with credit cards, because it wasn't clear that credit cards are loans covered by usury, right? And the banks and the credit cards got legal opinions as to whether it is or isn't, and they were mixed. I represented people at that time, and once you got to court, the company settled because they didn't want a ruling on whether it was covered by usury and ultimately got legislation. Now, I want to know if you know or if it's in the record, what was the practice, what was the industry's examination of the legality of what it was doing and the doctrine of equitable assignment?
So you're asking me that whether that we can just adapt to that, or?
Yeah, I'm asking you whether they reviewed that before they started in this business, or as they were going in this business and started getting these complaints or issues.
Well, most of the complaints and issues, I think, generally involve the MERS system.
Mm-hmm.
For a whole variety of reasons, and you've mentioned the counties and their, as you probably know, a number of federal lawsuits
mm-hmm.
brought by the counties against MERS. Sort of a different issue than the one I deal with or my client banks deal with or the client trade association deal with. As I mentioned, my clients are selling loans or buying loans totally unrelated to MERS.
Mm-hmm.
And those situations exist. And the law has been established. So an abrupt change in the law by this court would be really difficult.
Well, maybe the law should only change as to MERS transactions, not affect your clients.
Right. And unfortunately, MERS isn't even a party here, so it's hard to be that critical of them. I don't fully understand their system either, but I would personally feel more comfortable as a lawyer if they were a party and were attacking their system mm-hmm. or somebody is, and they can address that in front of a court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Knight.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Thrasher, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Knight and I are in complete agreement that having the note and mortgage held separately is bad precedent. That doesn't repeal or amend a statute, however. And it is something that the MERS architect should have thought about 20 years ago. The Chief Justice had asked about what kind of research that they do. If you want some background on that, I would recommend looking up New York Times Business Day of March 5, 2011. But a lot of cases, what they should have done is seek legislative relief from these unreasonable burdens, if they are unreasonable burdens. There are all kinds of federal statutes dealing with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and in one of these multitudinous cases that was cited, I don't remember which, I think I saw some discussion about there's enabling legislation for securitizing and bundling these home loans.
Mr. Thrasher, what about Mr. Knight's recitation of the case law going back to the 1800s that says that the mortgages follow the notes. The mortgage follows the note. And then he gave the example of when one bank might buy a branch or a whole different bank. And they don't buy the furniture, they don't buy the telephones, they buy the assets, which include the notes.
Yes, and there's a change in identity, but the note and the mortgage are still in the same hands. That's the only problem we have here.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand this.
The note and the mortgage will be in the same hands. Different hands than before,
yeah.
But still the same. Our problem is having somebody who has the power to enforce the mortgage on any given date. That's what we don't have. Now, of all...
Wouldn't it be whoever holds the note?
Well, of all of the cases that have been cited here, there is only one that I have seen that discusses simultaneously equitable assignment and the statute of frauds. And in that one case, the statute of frauds prevailed. We've discussed that at page 25 of our brief. It's a Massachusetts case, the Avenias case, I believe. What it held was that if somebody transfers the note but fails to transfer the security, they continue to hold it in trust for the transferee, which is precisely what our old case of Titiute, that happens to be a Pennsylvania small town, said. If you look at the language immediately following the Court of Appeals quotation, you will find that same kind of language. The transferee is entitled to the security, but it doesn't follow automatically. And if we look at it that way, we don't have a statute of frauds problem. But none of those old cases, almost none of them, even dealt with real estate. The what we have to keep in mind here, doesn't matter what the Sullivans knew. Sullivans aren't a party. They've been discharged in bankruptcy. Nobody is liable on the note. The note is merely a measure of enforcement of a lien. If we're concerned about floodgates, let me point this out. According to MERS non-party brief, there are supposedly agency relationships between MERS and all of its members. If that's true, if an adequate agency has been created in writing, then there is no problem, because MERS then would be empowered to act on behalf of the note owner. What's missing in this case is any proof of those agency relationships. If it's really true that they exist, there is no problem. When it comes to the securitized mortgages that are, you know, all kinds of people own shares in it, I'm no authority on this, but everyone I've seen is a trust. So the trust would hold the mortgage, not the many investors. So if you need an assignment, you only need it to one party, the trust, not a million investors out there. If, however, we're concerned that maybe those agency relationships aren't in order and the industry needs time to get its ducks in a row, I would point out what this court did in Hollett's against the city of Milwaukee, and that is delay its mandate. That can perfectly well be done and could be done here.
Let me ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. What kind of opinion do you want? Now I hear you saying that, hey, if MERS is really an agency, then this mortgage and note are in the same person, and it's okay.
So well, that should have been proved in summary judgment when we raised the issue, and it was not.
Is that what this court should say, that there's not adequate proof here that MERS is an agent, and there's not adequate proof that they can be equitable assignment here? I mean, is that what you want us to say?
I don't think agency is equitable assignment. The rule, as everybody seems to recite, is that the mortgage can be enforced by or on behalf of the owner or holder. Now, if, as MERS claims, it's empowered to so act, fine. All it had to do was prove it.
Well, is that what we send it back for? I want to know the rule of law you want this
no,
case to stand
I
for.
Want the court to say, first of all, the statute of frauds does apply to mortgage assignments. And in this particular case, and also that no one existed on the correct date who could enforce the mortgage. That's the date Dow bought. Now, the next step, obviously, you can go two ways. What I am suggesting is exactly what the restatement, as quoted by my opponents, says, and that is, at that date, it was unsecured. The note was unsecured. Not that it couldn't have been corrected, but that it was not on time. The alternative is if you hold that there is still a lien in spite of separate holding of the note and mortgage, then, of course, the facts relative to the investigation performed here are not of record and would have to be a matter of trial. But our preference is to hold that on the date Dow purchased, there was no lien.
Your clients were that confident when they purchased this property that they thought they could ignore the title commitment that said there was this obligation on the property?
Well, this is where there are facts unexplored as of yet, and certainly not of record. I do have some knowledge. I don't know at all. I wasn't in any way involved.
To me, the purpose, at least when I used to do real estate deals, if you got a title commitment and you wanted to be able to close, you had to satisfy the things on that list. Otherwise, your client was putting themselves into jeopardy, and I tried to remove those problems from the deal, not close with those problems clearly stated and listed.
Your Honor, we don't get to that point if there was no lien as a matter of law.
Okay, but I'm just saying, instead of litigating whether or not there's a lien, why not satisfy that question in your mind before you close?
I cannot speak for the people who were involved at the time. I can assure you there will be evidence of more investigation than is revealed on this record, but I don't think you want me to go there with facts not up record.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Thrasher. Thank you, Mr. Knight. Thank you, Ms. Anderson, for your arguments in what is a very presently relevant issue relating to mortgages that has dominated business and other news for the last 3 or 4 years. That ends our hearing on 13AP 221, Dow Family versus BHH Mortgage Corporation. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it comes back for its third case. Today, the students will remain. I will be out momentarily. They can remain.